Is your brain the same as your mind? We'll ask a neurosurgeon today on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. The mind-body problem, better titled the mind-brain problem, is about differentiation of the mind and the brain. Is the mind an emergent property of the brain, or is there something else going on there? Our guest is Dr. Michael Ignor. He's a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at State University of New York, Stony Brook. He's the director of pediatric neurosurgery. He's an award-winning brain surgeon. He was, in fact, named one of New York's best doctors by the New York Magazine in 2005. Dr. Ignor has lectured extensively throughout the United States and Europe, including at the opening ceremonies and the launching of the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence in Seattle in 2018. He is a senior fellow of Discovery Institute's Bradley Center and a frequent contributor to Mind Matters News. That's at mindmatters.ai. And Michael, your posts, your writings and posts to Mind Matters News always get a lot of hits, disproportionately high. So thank you for joining us here.
Thank you, Bob.
Emo Phillips, he said one day he was walking around and he recognized that his brain was the most wonderful organ in his body. Then he said he realized who was telling him this. it's kind of amazing, you know, Emo Phillips quip aside, it's kind of amazing we can use our minds to even partially understand our minds. So, Dr. Ignor, before we talk about minds, what constitutes a good theory of the mind and the way the mind relates to the body and the brain?
Well, it's a great question and a very important question. Actually, it was a question that Aristotle asked. When he, in his work De Anima on the soul, he asked, you know, what would a good explanation for the soul consist of? He felt, and I completely agree, that the first
now,
thing
if
is,
if I could interrupt you, you mentioned the idea of a soul. Is this kind of the idea of the mind according to Aristotle?
Yes, the classical philosophers really thought in terms of the soul more than in terms of what we would call the mind. And what we call the mind is kind of a subset of what the classical philosophers thought of as the soul. They saw the soul as that which makes a living body alive. So that they saw the soul as what we would call the mind, but also the physiological functions, you know, the heartbeat, all the physiology that goes along with it. I think that's a more sensible and comprehensive view of the human being. So what we think of as the mind is just several powers of the soul.
I see. So you were relating to the way that Aristotle thought about it.
Yes. He didn't separate out what we would call mental processes so sharply from ordinary physiology, breathing and heartbeat and muscle movement. He felt it was all kind of an integrated whole. It's actually one of the beauties of the Aristotelian way of looking at things. There's no artificial separation there. He sees it all as part of a whole.
I see. So could you be more specific what constitutes a good theory of the mind?
Sure.
And the way the mind relates to the body?
Well, the very first thing that we need is we need a theory that makes sense. And by that, I mean a theory that at least is not internally self-refuting. A good example, I think, of a self-refuting theory of the mind is eliminative materialism, which is a bizarre theory held by many materialists.
Could you repeat that
today.
Phrase, eliminated, sure. Eliminated materialism?
Eliminative materialism.
Eliminative, okay.
Yes, and it is the viewpoint that not only, well, it is the viewpoint that the only thing that exists is the brain, and that as far as the mind goes, and that there is no mind. That is, that what we have come to think of as our mind is just the physical processes going on inside our brain. That is different from another theory of mind called identity theory that was held in the 20th century that has been pretty much discarded. And identity theory was that the mind is the same thing as the brain. And that has been discarded because it's logical nonsense. That is, that every attribute of the mind, the reason and emotion and perception, all of those things, are completely different from matter. That is, that one describes matter in terms of extension in space or mass or various qualities like that. One describes perceptions and reason and emotions in completely different ways. There's no overlap between them. So the mental states can't be the same thing as physical states because they actually don't share any properties in common. They're clearly related to one another in important ways, but they're not the same thing. Eliminative materialists go one step further. They actually say that there are no mental states, that the only thing is the brain, which is kind of an odd thing to say, because what eliminative materialists therefore are saying is that their ideas are mindless. I mean, how can you have a proposition that the mind doesn't exist? Because that means propositions don't exist, and that means that you don't have a proposition.
So that's the self-refuting you were talking about.
Yeah. It's crazy. And Aristotle made that point. You know, the very first thing, if you're going to explain the soul or the mind, is that what you say has to make sense. There's a neuroscientist named Bennett and a philosopher named Hacker who've written extensively on this topic of neurophilosophy and written some very good things. And their motto is that the precondition of truth is sense. That is, that you can't pretend to have a scientific truth or a philosophical truth or any kind of truth if the statement you're making about it doesn't even make sense. And eliminative materialism is self-refuting. If it's true, then it's false. So the first thing is that your theory has to, in some way, make sense. And there are various theories that do kind of make sense to varying degrees. The second criterion is that you really need, the theory needs to offer a reasonably good explanation for the mind and for the body. It has to fit the evidence. You can't have a theory that makes sense, but it doesn't fit the evidence very well. You very much want it to be consistent with the results of neuroscience, obviously. I mean, neuroscience is a beautiful and powerful field. And any theory of the mind and the brain has to correspond to a significant degree with the findings in neuroscience. Neuroscience, I think, has been philosophically misguided in substantial ways, but we have to take the experimental evidence, the data, quite seriously, and try to understand it in a way that makes sense.
Certainly a lot has gone on with neuroscience since Aristotle. So with these three criteria, what are some of the theories of mind that are on tap that make sense according to the criteria you've outlined?
Sure. Making sense, of course, is to some extent relative, meaning some theories make more sense than other theories. By far the most common perspective today, I think both in the philosophical community and certainly in the neuroscience community, is materialism. Materialism, or what one might call physicalism or naturalism, they're all rather similar perspectives. And basically the perspectives there are that the only thing that exists are material things, things that are that you know, have extension in space and mass and things like that, in the natural world that can be described by the basic sciences like physics and chemistry. The materialists believe that there is no supernatural world. Materialists also believe that there are no agents or properties or entities in nature that don't have material origins, that there are no souls, there are no spirits, nothing like that. So the materialist perspective is certainly the dominant perspective in neuroscience today. I think it's a deeply misguided perspective, and it's, I believe, held by neuroscientists mainly because they haven't thought about it very deeply. It's kind of the default option. But when you think about it deeply, it doesn't provide a particularly satisfactory perspective on the mind and the brain.
Wouldn't a materialism ideology require that the mind be an emergent property of the brain?
Well, it might even limit us with the idea of emergence. That is, that materialism would only be completely consistent with an emergent perspective if the emergent thing was material. That is, that if one felt that some kind of immaterial soul emerged from brain activity, then that wouldn't even be a materialist view. Okay. And I think the emergence is a very problematic concept. I actually don't think it's a particularly useful concept in philosophy of mind.
I can also attest in the area of artificial life and such that emergence digitally from digital organisms and digital evolution has really fallen short of doing anything of that's truly meaningful.
Yeah, it basically doesn't do any lifting. It is essentially an invocation of magic. And there are two very serious problems with the concept of emergence in philosophy of mind. The usual emergent assertion is that the mind in some way is an emergent property of the brain. The problem with that assertion, number one, is that there are things that are considered to be emergent properties that are kind of accepted. A classic example is the wetness of water. And it's emergent in the sense that if one studies water rigorously from the standpoint of physics, there's nothing about it that's particularly wet. That is, it's you can study the quantum mechanical attributes of oxygen and hydrogen and all the chemistry and physics of water and not come out of that with anything that suggests that it's wet. But when you put real water in front of you and dip your finger in it, it's kind of wet. So people say that wetness is an emergent property of water.
That's curious.
The thing is, with the philosophy of mind, is that if a mind is an emergent property of the brain, what you're dealing with philosophy of mind is something that is ontologically completely different. That is, that there are no properties of mind that have any overlap with properties of brain. Thought and matter are not similar in any way. Matter has extension in space and mass. Thoughts have no extension in space and no mass. Thoughts have emotional states. Matter doesn't have emotional states. It's just matter. So it's not clear that you can get an emergent property when there's no connection whatsoever between that property and the thing it supposedly emerges from. The other problem with emergence, I think, is even more fundamental. And that is that when you think about, for example, the wetness of water as an emergent property of water, what you're really talking about is a psychological state. That is, you're saying that psychologically you didn't expect water to feel wet, but by golly, it does. So that's emergent. But you can't explain the psychological state itself as emergent.
Would the word qualia apply here?
Yes. Qualia is the subjective experience of things, the way things feel. One might say that it's first-person experience as opposed to third-person experience, which is objective. And it has been a notoriously difficult problem that has been addressed in many ways in the 20th century to try to explain how it is that the matter of the brain, which is entirely third-person, meaning it's got mass, it's got extension in space, it's things that you can study under a microscope. How is something that's third person objective capable of giving us first person subjective experience? David Chalmers, who's a very well-known philosopher of mind, has called that problem the hard problem of consciousness. And Chalmers has described two problems that we face in explaining consciousness. One is the easy problem of consciousness. And what he means by that really is neuroscience.
By the way, just to set the stage, Chalmers, would you classify him as a materialist? And coming from a materialist viewpoint, he is not.
Okay. No, he's not. He has a quality of panpsychism. That is, he kind of thinks that consciousness is a fundamental quality of everything, which sounds initially like it's kind of crazy, but I actually don't think it's nearly as crazy as it seems. I'm not a panpsychist. I don't think everything is conscious, but there is, in my view, no question that all of created reality manifests mental things. That is, that there's clearly a mind in some way manifested in reality. I don't think reality has a mind, but I don't think you can separate mind from reality. So I can see where panpsychists are coming from. I think they're wrong, but they're not completely wrong.
Now, you're going through some of the different theories of the mind that are on tap, and we've gone through materialism, and I'm sorry, I derailed you on your talking about Chalmers' theory, but
that's okay.
What are some of the other models of the mind other than materialism?
Sure. Well, one would be panpsychism, which is or some people also would have something called neutral monism. Those are views that consciousness is sort of just a fundamental property of everything.
Wouldn't that also be materialist?
Not really, because it would describe mental activities as not inherently material. That is, that mental activities are real, and they exist in association with matter, but they aren't the same thing as matter. It's sort of the idea that the real substance that forms the universe is inherently conscious, and we are just particularly dramatic examples of it.
I remember a post that you wrote for Mind Matters News, which was "Electrons are not conscious," which is on this. I believe, though, right, that a panpsychist can also be an atheist. Usually I equate materialism with atheism, but you said that there's broader things than materialism, such as panpsychism, which can also be embraced by an atheistic perspective.
Is Sure. Panpsychism doesn't, at least as it's normally endorsed, doesn't necessarily have any theistic implication. I think you can easily be an atheist and be a panpsychist. I don't think you can be an atheist and be rational, meaning that when you look with rigor at the question of the existence of God, I don't think you can be a rational atheist. But there are lots of irrational atheists, and some of them are panpsychists.
I see. Okay. So we have materialism, panpsychism. What other theories of the mind are on tap?
Well, there are a number of dualist theories of the mind. Dualism, just generally considered, is the viewpoint that mental states are not the same thing as material states, as brain states. That there is, when you consider the material aspects of, for example, a human being, that there is a remainder that is mental, that is not material. But there are a variety of ways of looking at dualism. Kind of the classical dualist way of looking at things, at least in modern philosophy, is Cartesian dualism, which was proposed by Descartes back in the 17th century. And he proposed that human beings are composites of matter extended in space, and of spirit, which he thought of as a thinking substance. So he thought that there were two separate substances that were joined to form a human being, and basically the material body joined to the immaterial spirit. And there certainly are good things to say about the Cartesian understanding of the mind and body, but I think it's fundamentally misguided from a philosophical and logical standpoint, and that it actually has done quite a bit of harm philosophically, because it was described in the 20th century by a philosopher named Gilbert Ryle as the ghost in the machine. And that is that Descartes understood human beings basically to be biological machines that were inhabited by a ghost, which is the spirit or the mind. And materialists have simply said, well, there's no ghost. So we'll just understand human beings as biological machines.
I see.
And that's a profound error, but Descartes opened the door to that. But the perspective that Descartes cast aside was that of hylomorphism, which is
Slow down. What was it called again?
Oh, sure. Hylomorphism, H-Y-L-O-M-O-R-P-H-I-S-M. Some people spell it H-Y-L-E-M-O-R-P-H-I-S-M. And that's that all of nature consists of a composite of form and matter. Morphism means matter, and hyl is the Greek word for form. Is the Greek word for matter. So hylomorphism means that everything in nature is a composite of form, which is Aristotle would call a principle of intelligibility, and matter, which is a principle of individuation. It's a rather profound metaphysical perspective. And in that perspective, the soul or the mind is the form of the body. But it's a different perspective than Descartes' perspective. And it doesn't see mind and body as being separate substances. It sees a human being as being a unitary thing with different principles involved, but not different substances.
One of the criteria that you mentioned for establishing a good model of the mind-brain problem is consistency with results of neuroscience. How do these three different theories stack up? Materialism, panpsychism, and dualism.
Sure. Panpsychism, I think, while I do think there can be some, I could see how a person might make that inference. Some very intelligent people like Dr. Chalmers have made that inference. I don't think panpsychism is a particularly scientific viewpoint. Realistically speaking, there's no particular reason to think that that electrons or grains of sand have minds.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking, how the heck would you ever test something like that?
Right, right. Well, you could ask an electron, and people have tried, and the electrons don't answer. It's a difficult thing to test. Materialists have, of course, made the claim that neuroscience completely supports materialism. I had an internet debate with Dr. Stephen Novello, who is a neurologist at Yale a number of years ago, and he's a materialist. And Dr. Novello said that every single bit of evidence in the history of neuroscience supports materialism, which I think is not the case. Materialists would claim that neuroscience supports materialism. The problem with that is that neuroscientists generally work from a materialist perspective, and they ask questions of the mind and the brain from a materialist perspective. And goodness gracious, it's no surprise that if that's the way you ask the questions, then materialism always seems like it's the answer. When I was in college, I had a professor of biology, Dr. Pollack, who I really loved. He was a great professor, a great philosopher, as well as a great scientist. And his adage was that in science, the question you ask is more important than the answer you obtain. That is, that the way you approach the problem and the kind of question you ask determines how meaningful your answer is. And if you get the question wrong up front, then your answer won't be meaningful no matter what kind of work you do. So you've got to ask the right questions. So if you're a materialist and all your questions are predicated on the materialism, you're never going to get it right. So I think dualism is a much, much better explanation for many aspects of neuroscience.
That was my next question. Do you, speaking as an experienced neurosurgeon who has played around with the brains of many, many people, what do you believe? Do you believe that the mind is distinct from the brain as a dualist does?
I think, first of all, that if one is going to understand the mind and the brain, you need to start with a solid metaphysical foundation. And I think hylomorphism is a solid metaphysical foundation. I don't think Cartesian dualism is a good metaphysical foundation, and I certainly don't think materialism is a good metaphysical foundation. I think the best explanation for the relationship of the mind to the brain is Aristotelian hylomorphism, which is the viewpoint that the soul is the form of the body, and certain powers of the soul, particularly the intellect and will, are not generated by matter, but are immaterial things, what Thomas Aquinas would call the spirit. But other properties of the mind, like perception and memory and imagination, are physical. They are directly related to brain matter, and they're generated by brain matter. I think that's the best explanation philosophically for what we find in neuroscience.
Very good. Most of the debates about the mind-brain problem have been argued over the years by philosophers and theologians, I believe. However, we do have the emerging field of neuroscience. Do you have any thoughts what neuroscience is going to tell us about the mind-brain problem in the near future, or in the far future even?
Well, as Dr. Pollack said, it all depends on the questions we ask. My favorite quote about neuroscience was by a philosopher named Roger Scruton, who described neuroscience as a vast collection of answers with no memory of the questions.
You have to unpack that. What does that mean? Everybody has the answers, but it's not asking the questions?
Yes. And I should point out that Scruton is not, I mean, I believe he's an atheist, so he's not a sort of your typical dualist. And I don't even know if he'd consider himself a dualist. But what he points out is that neuroscience is done with such an unreflective and rather primitive materialist predicate that people don't even really think about what their experiments mean. That they just spew out the data. It spew out the data, attach a materialistic explanation to it, and just go on to your next experiment without thinking deeply about what are the real questions in these experiments? What are you really trying to find out? And he's quite right that neuroscience is a vast collection of answers, meaning if you took all the data that has been generated by neuroscientists over the past century, you could fill libraries brimming over. I mean, the amount of research, and a lot of it is really good research, really high quality stuff. It's amazing. The philosophical insight and reflection that is associated with this work is basically at the level of a not terribly bright elementary school child, meaning that it's amazing how bad the philosophy is. I once asked a neuroscientist here where I work. We were having a discussion one time about the mind and the brain, and I asked him how is it that neurons in the cortex are associated with mental states. And he just said, they just generate them. That's all.
Oh, boy.
And I think, well, that's you didn't really say anything. It wasn't any, that's not a level of explanation. And he didn't think there was a problem with that. He just said, yeah, they generate them. So what?
Boy, you talk about blind faith.
Well, yes. And it's like, as Scruton said, no memory of the questions, doesn't even understand the question. And that's what struck me most about materialists in neuroscience, is that they don't even know what they don't know. They don't even realize how little they can really explain.
Well, this is the fun thing that I've had in my conversations with you, that you've looked at some of these neurosurgeon, neuroscience sort of results and been able to apply some philosophy to them. And we're going to talk about them in some subsequent podcast. Thank you, Dr. Ignor. Our guest has been Dr. Michael Ignor. He's a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at State University of New York. And we're going to continue our conversation with him next time on Mind Matters News. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.